This is the Education Gadfly Show.
It's not going to be some law that Congress passes that's going to radically change bullies' hearts.
All bullies left behind.
Cash for bullies. So it's a new stimulus program.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, straight from the Kardashian wedding, John Bailey.
Hello, good to be here.
Hey, John, how are you?
It was a great wedding.
John, we should, other than saying that you were a guest at that celebrity wedding, we should introduce you. What you seem to have multiple titles these days, but you work at Dutco Worldwide, right?
I do.
And a smaller branch of that, correct?
That's correct. Well. Whiteboard Advisors. We're the non-lobbying entity of Dutco Worldwide.
Okay, but you still do work for many of the evil corporations that anti-reformers like to talk about.
We do, with the sinister giggles and laughs, but yes, we work with for-profit as well as non-profit foundations and corporations.
John, this is why they're labeling reform as corporate reform. It's all are you working on that, I hope? You know, how do you get that? I've been trying. I've been trying to push against that. Because, look, when I think corporate reform, I think, things that corporations are pushing for. Things like, you know, business leaders, they're like, let's do professional development. Let's have more STEM. Woo-hoo-hoo. They're not willing to do anything controversial. You know, I mean, the stuff that's coming seriously is not from corporations. It's coming from, I mean, if anything, Diane's billionaire boys club is more likely. It's rich guys who are trying to shake things up.
Yeah. And a lot of for-profit startups, too, coming out of Silicon Valley and some of the business schools. So people who sort of focusing their entrepreneurial energy in K-12, not through the nonprofit route, but through this.
Yeah, I know, but that's the problem, because you represent people who are trying to make money on the backs of poor kids.
Yeah. Back to poor kids. That's exactly right.
It's a messaging problem, John. It's an issue. All right. Glad to have you here. John and I served jointly at once upon a time in the George W. Bush administration. And, those days so long ago.
I was just going to say. Seems just like yesterday.
It does. And yet it seemed like an eternity at the
time.
That's
right.
All right. Well, we got lots to cover this week. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly with Daniela. Then we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute and Chris Irvine's What's Up With That? So let's get started, Daniela. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Thanks for having me, guys. Last week, a New York judge ruled that the state's regents had overstepped their bounds when they required that 40% of teacher evaluations be based on state test scores. DFERS Joe Williams said of the ruling, a mediocre evaluation just got weaker. Is this the right take?
What do you think, John?
Well, I mean, my sense of it is that this is what the teachers union does best, is that they try to gum up education reform in the courts and also trying to force everything to be collectively bargained. And so, you know, I think that's what they were trying to do here, is try to get a lawsuit to try to make that 40% of teachers' evaluation based on growth as well as student achievement based, you know, a little bit lower, down to 20%. But my sense is that it was a awkwardly phrased law that they sort of took advantage of. So I think all it's going to do is make sure that states are much more clear in defining what these measures are going forward.
And see, I got a little different opinion on this one. See, I think it's ridiculous that reformers are going to court over 20% versus 40% of the teacher evaluation being based on test scores, because, look, it is early days in this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know how this stuff is going to play out. We are just beginning to try to take teacher evaluation seriously. Mm-hmm. Look, I understand that 40% may make it easier to get bad teachers with bad test scores out of the classroom. It might also create all kinds of unhealthy pressure, though, for all schools in New York State to teach to the test, which is not necessarily something that we want, parents are going to want. So look, do we know which one is right? The law, you know, from my understanding, was pretty clear that it said, look, 20% based on state test scores, and then the other 20 on other student achievement. And the region said, well, let's make the other student achievement also based on the test scores. That seemed like it was a stretch to begin with. I say, call off the lawyers. Don't spend the money on an appeal. Just get down to work. Create the evaluation. Let's get on with it.
I mean, I think the more interesting question is, what does this mean for New York with Race at the Top now, since this was something that they had proposed as part of their application and were awarded based on that? So what does this mean for the department now? Is this a major change? Can they still execute their Race at the Top plan the way that they promised to? And it'll be interesting to see how the department handles this next.
Right. Okay. Topic number two.
John Covington abruptly announced a career shift this week, moving from the superintendency of Kansas City Schools to heading up Michigan's new recovery school district, thanks in part to a big, fat raise. Are there national implications here?
What do you think, John?
You know, I think this is a little bit of a PR battle that he sort of lost. I mean, I think if you look at most urban superintendents, they're earning, you know, pretty significant sums as well as salaries, as well as some other benefits there. I mean, his comes in around $325 a year. That's a little bit higher than the average, but it's still around the same amount that other superintendents are getting paid. And he's taking on worse.
The new job is going to come with the new $300K plus.
Yeah. And so all they're doing is sort of tabulating his 4-year contract into an upper level. But if you look at most urban superintendents, they're getting paid right around this much if you throw in other benefits and other expenses as well. And I think he's taking on the worst of the worst schools. And he's had a pretty good track record in the district he was in. So, you know, I say more power to him.
You know, I got to meet John earlier this year. Was it last year when he came and spoke on a panel at Fordham about doing more with less? He had closed half of Kansas City's schools because they were under-enrolled. That was quite a tough thing to do. And then he's also been aggressive about recruiting Teach for America to his district. He comes out of the Broad fellow world. But of course the folks in Kansas City are not happy. I mean, you know, this guy was leading their efforts. He was making good progress. It does look like he was not being paid all that well in Kansas City. And so that's part of the issue. But are we just back to the same, even with the Broad stuff coming online, it still seems like we just don't have enough good urban superintendents to go around.
Yeah, and I think we also have the problem too of churn, where, you know, a lot of superintendents come into a district, they launch lots of initiatives and then they leave. You know, so usually after, you know, 3.5 or 4 years. And that's, you know, part of the problem is that you have lots of initiatives getting launched, but not a lot of superintendents sticking around to see what the actual results of those initiatives produce.
I mean, how do other fields deal with this? I mean, you look in sports, right? And, you know, sports players, they generally have contracts.
Salary cap.
Right?
That's right.
I'm not talking salary cap. I'm talking contracts here, right? I mean, and they don't break those contracts. I mean, how do we get to the point where we say, look, you are making a moral commitment to this city. And if the board is stable and provides you with what you need to be successful, you'll stick it out.
Yeah. Instead of front loading the contracts, how do you sort of backload them? So it's rewarding people who stick around longer, have a little bit more performance, because he's getting a signing bonus with this. And then, you know, it's sort of a phasing in of his salary, but still it's pretty front loaded, not back loaded.
You can also buy a pretty nice house in Michigan right now for not a lot of money.
You can.
Okay, topic number three.
I think that was probably it. He just wanted a pool. Question number three. Politicians are passing laws targeting bullies. Policy wonks are yawning. Is the education reform world ignoring an important issue?
And don't bully me about this.
Yeah, Mike used to knock my books down at the Department of Education exactly. When we were going to the secretary's office.
Oh, come on. There was a bully back then. Her name was Margaret Spellings. Cha-ching!
Wow.
Just kidding. Okay.
The opinions expressed here are
okay.
Those of...
Yes, I want to rope you into that, John. I don't want you to get on our bad list. It is my impression that the reform crowd totally ignores this issue. Mm-hmm. And yet you see state after state pass laws. New Jersey has an aggressive one. It got reported this week. Is this something that we're out to lunch on? This is something parents seem to really worry about.
Yeah, I think the problem is that there's not much that government entities can do about this. You have, you know, a lot of federal agencies have put together a website called www.stopbullying.gov. The problem is I don't think many bullies are going to www.stopbullying.gov. So, you know, I think part of this is named it
Don't Be a Bully.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be a bully. Yeah. Let 1,000 websites bloom and we've addressed the problem. So I think that's the problem. Like, most government entities, except for school districts, can't really address this. And I think it's better left to schools and teachers and local community organizations, churches, synagogues, and other groups to kind of handle this. I think it's probably a problem. It's probably just not a federal or national education issue that needs to be part of Race to the Top next year.
But it's interesting. I think it's important for us to remember that parents see the world very differently than policy wonks do. And that, you know, policymakers might be all focused on international competitiveness, for example. Makes sense. If you're worried about the future of the country, you worry about that. As a parent, you know, you don't look at your little, you know, child and say, oh, I hope you're going to be internationally competitive someday. You know, I mean, you want them to be happy and to go up and, you know, get a good job and, you know, have a, you know, strong merit, whatever. I mean, you have aspirations for them, but you worry if they're getting picked on at school, you know. But so I think sometimes this rhetoric that we talk about, it just doesn't connect with parents.
Yes, I would agree. And it's also about providing environments that kids can, you know, be safe in and feel like they can be nurtured and grow and be successful. But again, that all of that is really determined at that local level. It's not going to be some law that Congress passes that's going to radically change bullies' hearts to make them nicer. I don't think, at least.
All bullies left behind.
That's right. Yeah. Cash for bullies. So okay. It's a new stimulus program.
Good. I like that.
Get bullies off the streets and get, you know, cleaner kids into schools.
Yeah. Good. Very good. All well said. All right. That's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you. Well played, John. Thank you, Daniela.
Thanks, guys.
It's now time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Amber, were you the victim of bullying when you went to school?
I never was the victim. But although, I gotta say, I remember Peter Quilla. This is sad. To this day, Peter Quilla was picked on. I've always felt guilty. I did not defend Peter Quilla.
And do we know what's happened to Peter?
He's probably, you know, a brain scientist because, you know, he was one of those nerdy kids in school that just, you know, got 101 average or something, so.
Yeah. Now, that was Brian Dale at our school. I remember the kids tying him to a fence post. And again, I didn't do anything really to stop it.
I know, that's what's terrible. Bystanders. I mean, you know,
but you were not a bully.
For life.
You were not
no,
a bully.
I was not a bully, but I was not a bully protector either, so.
Okay. All right. Oh, well, bully
there
you
for
have you. It. Okay, so what you got for us this week?
All right, this week, hate to do it to you, but got another study on Common Core, this time by David Conley and colleagues. In short, they survey college professors who teach entry-level courses and ask them if the standards are applicable and important to their courses. We know there's a lot of confusion about what it means to be college-ready, so the study, you know, it's important to query these college professors. It's kind of similar to what ACT does. Anyway, professors were recruited from 2- and 4-year institutions, roughly 1,900 of them responded. They taught courses in 25 subject areas, ELA, math, science, social science, business management, computer technology, and so on. Professors of all subjects were asked to respond to both the ELA and math standards, so that's interesting, with the idea that these standards are relevant to a range of disciplines. Key findings, the ELA strands around speaking, listening, and language were deemed by roughly 80% of the sample as relevant and important to their courses, no surprise. Most instructors, 77 plus, also reported that mathematical practices were applicable. This is stuff like applying math to everyday life. Roughly 40% reported that the math strands around number and quality, algebra, statistics, and probability were applicable. Just a couple things with methods, though. It was basically two questions, you know, is this applicable? How important is it? Everybody who said one said the other, naturally. It was just two questions. I think that was good in terms of the simplicity because they were asked to respond to a ton of standards. But I'm going to have to agree with Common Core dissenter Zev Werman, if you guys read his response to this. Basically, he said, you know, they could have probed a lot deeper regarding the comparative rigor of the standards. I agree with that. And they should have also aggregated respondents by their content expertise so we could determine, for instance, you know, how many ELA professors responded to the math questions. So in the end, I think it was important to survey these guys on the relevance of the standards post-high school level, but it had some problems, I think, with the survey design.
Yeah, I mean, so, and Zev also made the case, and I think this is legitimate, that this it was just designed to get the answer that Conley wanted, that David Conley was involved
that's
in
right,
drafting
the validation
these standards
committee. Mm-hmm.
And the validation committee, and this was to say, see, this stuff is valid.
Yeah, funded by Gates, which doesn't, you know, doesn't mean, obviously, but still, I mean, I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, everybody's sort of got a, you know, little piece of the action with Common Core. A lot of folks do. So it casts suspicion. Doesn't mean that it's a bad study, but it could have been better.
Yeah. I mean, so now are we going to get to the point where we stop arguing and studying the standards themselves and get
right,
onto something
get to
else,
it, right?
Right.
That's
and to whether
right.
this stuff is actually happening in the world. John, in your world, I mean, you work with a lot of these nonprofit, for-profit entrepreneurs. I mean, is Common Core a big deal to those folks?
Yeah, I would definitely say. I mean, you have most providers trying to orient their services or products, nonprofit or for-profit, around Common Core. But I would say the biggest challenge is that you just have, this would have been another interesting question on just what was the level of familiarity that the college professors had, because I'm finding there's a lot of people, including districts, that know very little about the Common Core. They've heard about it, but very little sort of education or in-depth knowledge of what the standards are. Lots of opinions, but sometimes not always based on knowledge of the standards themselves. But yeah, it's a very big deal, at least amongst a lot of the providers who are hoping to offer services across state lines.
Now, a lot of us worry that those providers are going to say that they're aligned with the Common Core, but you know, not actually do a whole lot to make that happen. I mean, what's your sense out there?
No, I think that's a big problem because you have, and you had that before too, with vendors as well as providers saying that they were aligned to state standards, but there was no sort of official endorsement of that. Right. So I know CCSSO and the Common Core organizations are trying to think about, funded again by Gates, but trying to figure out a way of doing some sort of certification process. But I think that's probably still a few years out.
Okay. All right, Amber, so what song goes along with this?
Well, since we're talking about needing more than the basics in college, we have a song about the basics. It's ABC by Jackson 5.
ABC.
I can never get enough of the Jackson 5, Johnny.
Me neither. It's on my playlist all the time.
Excellent. All right, now it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Bed, had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that? Yes,
sir. Hey, Chris, what you got for us today?
Well, it's not often that I find my stories from Forbes magazine, but one particular incident that took place in Massachusetts profiled online this week was just too ridiculous to be true. One day last week, Christopher Carr, a father of two whose family relocated to Massachusetts after the massive earthquake in Japan, he helped his 12-year-old son set up a lemonade stand. Except the boy wasn't selling lemonade, he was selling green tea and smoothies. Any of you thinking, what's up with that, at this point, are not alone. And I'd probably say it myself, were the stand to be found anywhere but the Northeast or Bay Area regions of the country. Anyhow, upon returning to the stand after making lunch for his daughter, Carr discovered his son was no longer selling any beverages. The boy was ordered to close up shop by the police for not having a permit to operate. What's up with that? Not operating without a permit? What was he thinking? That kid should have paid more attention in his business law classes. As it so happens, the local police had nothing to do with shutting the stand down. In fact, they stopped by and wished the boy luck on his venture. Indeed, it was the state police, or the stateies as they're so lovingly referred to, that spoiled the boy's fun. By golly, I bet that state trooper must have felt like a real man after making an example out of a middle school student. Good thing you got him, officer. Selling green tea at those prices for even a few hours would put Starbucks' entire business model in serious jeopardy. The Massachusetts State Police, protecting American jobs one lemonade stand at a time.
John, just one more example of the government getting in the way with its red tape and regulations, huh?
Job-killing policies right there. What's next, sitting in SWAT teams after Girl Scout cookies? I mean, come on.
Yes.
This is ridiculous.
What a Rick Perry or Mitt Romney. Get them on this. This is ridiculous.
We need tax credits for kids. Exactly. Lemonade entrepreneurs, not...
You know, I have to say, so seriously, on the education front, you know, there's groups out there that promote teaching entrepreneurship in schools. And I've always been a little bit skeptical. Like, this is one of the millions of things that we want our schools to do on top of academics. Saying, hey, maybe this is something that's better done, you know, after school program, mm-hmm. as a club, you know, and a lemonade stand. I mean, what do you think? I mean, you work with entrepreneurs. Do mm-hmm. they like this idea? Is this something you have to teach in school? Or can we just focus on the basics in our educational
system? No, I think you could definitely focus on the basics. And I mean, I think what you find is that a lot of schools where student entrepreneurs sort of come out of do this in after school programs or other things. You sometimes see schools have students run stores so they can learn a little bit more about business. A lot of computer science classes have kids making iPhone apps now. Mm-hmm. So I think there's all sorts of ways to encourage entrepreneurship without being soft on the basics. And pretty much, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to have to know how to read and write. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to be really effective in your communication, and you're going to have to know math. Otherwise, you'll end up in big financial crises like we just ended up.
Exactly. Hey, note to Joe, our producer, let's get one of those high school students doing an iPhone app for the Education Gadfly Show. Excellent. Okay. Okay, well, that is all the time we've got for today's show. Until next time,
I'm John Bailey.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.